There's a line in the musical Hamilton, sung by Alexander Hamilton. It goes, "In the face of ignorance and resistance, I wrote financial systems into existence," which of course he did. But this week, I've been thinking a lot about financial systems. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. I'm talking about the financial systems through which we get paid, and what the minimum wage ought to be, the systems through which we retire, and how the government oversees that, and the global elite who, as revealed in the Panama Papers leak, sometimes operate on their own system. Come tell us what you think of the show and systems at Marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. We're starting this week, as we do most weeks, with our segment Long and Short. It's our system for stealing phrases from the financial world and applying them to the world of news. And this week, to tell us what they are betting on or against, we have Marketplace's own Tracy Samuelson and Jillian White, a senior associate editor at The Atlantic. Welcome back to you both.
Hi.
Hey, Lizzie.
Jillian, why don't we kick this off with you, since you're our outside guest this week. What are you long?
So I am long sad desk lunch. And I want to be super clear about this. I'm not long on this because I love it and think it's awesome. I am long on this because it is not going anywhere. This week I had possibly the saddest sad desk lunch of my entire life. The refrigerator accidentally froze my salad, and I was too busy to run out and get something else, so I just kind of nuked it for a little while and then ate some wilted greens, and it was very disgusting. But it did not stop me from eating it. And more than that, Taco Bell recently announced that they will start allowing people to order delivery via Slack.
The messaging app.
Yeah. So it feels like it's really taking the let's all just eat lunch at our desk thing to the next level. So I don't think that's going anywhere anytime soon.
Whenever I do escape from my desk and I wander around New York City in the middle of the day and I notice like a full restaurant, I just want to go up to all of these people and be like, "Hi, who are you? Like, what are you doing that you have time to sit in a restaurant and eat a meal?
What is your secret?
What is your secret?
And
can I be you? Can I join you?"
Yeah.
I would like to propose for the Labor Department a different measure of productivity. Maybe we just start recording the number of American workers who eat a sad desk lunch and see if it corresponds to overall economic output. And then once we do that, we'll know whether this has any, you know, positive effect on our workplaces or if we're all just living really sad lives.
That is perfect. I will sign that petition.
The sad lunch indicator.
The sad lunch indicator. Tracy Samuelson, give me your long.
Okay, so I am long a move by France this week to penalize the clients of prostitution rather than the prostitute or the sex worker. So that is a shift that other countries have made that, you know, that people have been calling for a long time to at least even the sort of criminality, if not shift it from the prostitute to the client. And I think that's a really interesting, compelling change.
Ooh. Yeah, from a policy standpoint, certainly we've seen some countries in Scandinavia approach the issue this way, and some people have talked about it in the U.S., so I don't feel like I see that changing here, apart from a couple of state laws.
Yeah, Sweden and Norway, I think, have both made a similar move, but you're right. I don't think I see it happening in the U.S. anytime soon.
But you're long on the sort of incremental change?
I'm long on the idea, yeah. It's cool. Going after, I guess, the demand side instead of the supply.
Yeah. Instead of the supply.
Yeah.
All right, Jillian, roll out your short.
I mean, this is going to be a slightly controversial one. No one be mad at me, but I am short on all of the outrage over the Panama Papers. Not that I think that it's not warranted. I just think it will ultimately be pretty short-lived. I think this is an issue that we have known has been going on for a very long time. I think it's unsurprising. I think the biggest thing that happened was the ability to kind of see who those clients were and see the level of tax avoidance that was happening. But I think if some serious changes don't happen while there's the political will and while there's the outrage right at this moment, you know, some of the bigger things like the Icelandic prime minister having to resign, like things like that are great, but I don't think at the end of the day, unless there's some serious change right at this moment while it's popular and while it's hot, that this is going to change all that much. It's also a pretty layered and nuanced issue.
Yeah, I think that is what the people who have been working on this for years hope, is that this is just kind of one more moment to try and get some action on this, but we have. I mean, you've seen legislation in the U.S. since starting in around 2008, I think, that's just been reintroduced a few times, including again this past February. It's never really gone anywhere, trying to get states to gather ownership, better ownership information when a company incorporates. You're also seeing Treasury now releasing a rule that's also been years in the making, or soon to release a rule that's been years in the making, that tries to get banks to collect better ownership information from corporate account holders, trying to close a loophole there because they already have to do it for their individual customers. So all of this stuff has been years in the making. So the question is, Jillian, you're right, like whether this event gives it the momentum to actually push some change. And I don't know. It sounds like you're pretty skeptical.
I think the one thing I am watching is the question of what happens politically for David Cameron in the sort of aftermath of all of this. He admitted to ITV that he did profit from his father's offshore fund. If something actually happens there, then maybe we see more than, oh, yeah, lots of people hide assets offshore. If not, I don't know. I'm sort of equivocal on this one.
I think that's a great point. You know, how far is the punishment or the anger going to go? If it really far out there and if there are a ton of ripple effects, sure. But I do wonder, you know, how big of an impact will it have? Will people, you know, draw the line at whether people had intentionally created these offshore accounts or just benefited from them, you know, in a secondary way? Yeah, I think it'll be interesting.
Jillian White from The Atlantic, Tracy Samuelson from Marketplace, thank you both very much.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. Last week on our long and short segment, our Kimberly Adams alluded to this next story, a big change in the way retirement systems work and retirement accounts are regulated. This week, the Labor Department came out with a rule they've been working on for a long time, tightening what's called the fiduciary standard, meaning someone who's acting as your financial advisor for many types of retirement accounts has to put your best interests before theirs. It's a little complicated, so we brought on Jill Schlesinger to explain. She's a CBS business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Welcome back.
Great to be with you.
How does this all change?
So the big distinction that's happened here is that there is different standards of care applied to financial professionals, basically two different types. One is that investment professionals have to be providing advice that is suitable to their clients. What's suitable? It means, look, whatever I sell you or advise you to do, it has to be appropriate for you, but it does not necessarily have to be in your best interest. The other standard is called the fiduciary duty, and that means that if an investment consultant, a broker, an insurance salesman recommends that you take some action in your retirement account, he or she has to basically say, this is in your best interest. This is really the best thing for you to do. And you can see the difference. It really seems subtle, but actually the public always thought that investment professionals were held to fiduciary, and they weren't. So now we're just saying, look, everyone thinks you're giving the advice that's in my best interest. Now we're just going to hold you to it.
How will that play out on a practical level for most people?
The person at the other end of the line is going to have to say to you, well, first of all, we need to have a conversation here about what else is going on in your life, right? I got to know more about you before I can give you advice. And if after that conversation, the person says, you know, based on our conversation, I think you should roll over your old retirement plan into an IRA rollover account, I have to fully disclose why that's the advice that's in your best interest. I also have to tell you if I'm going to get paid a fee for doing that. And I also have to make clear whether that is a move that is going to either cost you more money or less money than what you have currently. And there are certain exceptions and carve-outs for this. But generally speaking, if you think about it, it's like going to the doctor and saying, you're going to tell me the best course of action for me. That's what you're going to do, right? And you're also going to disclose if you get paid for me taking that action or not and what that fee is.
So is there any way in which this is not a win for consumers?
there are critics who have said in the, you know, from the financial services industry, and they spent millions of dollars lobbying against this rule, that the new rules will be so onerous, they'll have to hire tons more compliance people, they're going to have to really beef up all of their systems, and that that's going to cost them money. Therefore, they may not be able to actually service smaller accounts. So they really took the stand that this new standard would be bad for middle-class Americans with smaller retirement accounts.
Do you think this new rule is going to save consumers money?
Yeah, I think that the money, it's so weird. Like, for me, the money is not the biggest issue. And we've talked about this with a lot of people in the industry. But I think the cost of investing is going down. And that is the democratization of the process. That's fantastic. But the cost of advice has always been steep. But what I do think it is very important here is that this rule really starts to clarify the role that this important advisor, salesperson, whoever, is playing in a person's life. And I can't stand the industry's position that, you know, oh, this is bad for the investor. I take the other approach. Tell me what other profession does not think putting the client's interest first is tantamount to that trust relationship. It's no wonder that the industry has a bad rap. If they fight so hard about putting our interest first, we really should be suspect.
This is a huge change. This rule was worked on for years. Can people just go, okay, I'm in good shape now?
You'd like to think that. But this is, I really think this is akin to your health, that you go to the doctor and, you know, as much as we complain about it, we do take responsibility for our own care. And you really do need to ask questions of the person who is providing financial advice. And the easiest one to ask is, are you registered as a fiduciary? Are you held to the fiduciary standard? But the other is, if you don't understand something, you don't just sign your life away. And if you've got a weird feeling in your belly, you don't do it.
Jill Schlesinger is the CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money. Thank you, Jill.
Great to be with you.
There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. There's a reason why we do the numbers on Marketplace, because behind every number in the business world is often a great story. On our website, marketplace.org, our By the Numbers blog finds the most interesting numbers in the news. Here are Marketplace's Tony Wagner and Raghu Manavalan with this week's news by the numbers. Tony?
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
132 million.
That's how many votes were cast for American Idol in 2012, the last year numbers were made available.
Even though ratings slipped, that's more votes than Americans cast in that year's presidential election.
Of course, on Idol, people could vote more than once.
The show ended its 15-season run this year, but we'll always remember it for its great moments and showing us democracy in action. Or, you know, something like that.
$14 billion.
That's how big this used smartphone market is supposed to be next year, according to Gartner Research.
Apple's trying to use its huge stockpile of refurbished iPhones to break into India's huge market.
But the country's manufacturers are pushing back. They say a flood of phones would hurt them and lead to waste.
$4.7 billion.
That's how much Domino's made last year just from digital sales.
Since revamping its recipe a few years ago, the pizza company has made a name for itself in the world of online ordering.
Its newest innovation is an app called Zero Click, which will order pizza within 10 seconds after opening, unless you tell it not to.
Hey, Tony, we should get some pizza.
Where'd you get that fresh pepperoni? Your toppings are ill, but the cheese is homely. Only order one slice when you're feeling
lonely, because the sausage tastes like stale bologna. Still better than nothing. Last week on the show, we asked you to tell us about what you're wasting, whether it's something tangible, like half a pot of coffee in your office break room, or something harder to see, like data from streaming a feed of bears eating salmon while you wait for the subway. Guilty. What's it costing you? A few of you said you were wasting produce, like Emily Greenman Wright from Kalamazoo, Michigan.
The thing that drives me the craziest is pre-washed baby salad greens. And I feel like no matter what I do, no matter how my intentions, like how high they are, I end up like losing about a third of the package.
It does it turn into that like soggy kind of squishy mess at the bottom?
Yes.
So, I mean, I have to ask you, how much money do you think you waste doing this?
My initial calculations were about like $65 a year. And then I did some better math and probably around $45. But it's a really nice luxury. I know that I could prepare lettuce and wash it and put it through the salad spinner, but I know that we'd be less likely to eat it.
So, but it sounds like also for you, when you sort of calculate out all of the costs writ large that go into this, losing that $45 or whatever it is worth it because, what, it makes you eat your leafy greens?
I think we eat more salad as a result.
I think my favorite outcome of you responding to this question is that someone on our Facebook page, like another listener, was giving you tips. What happened?
I actually got a really good suggestion, which I think could work, because moisture is the issue with salad greens. Like, it's the bottom third that gets too moist, and so the water gets absorbed by the greens, and that's why they turn to mush. So one listener also said to kind of put a paper towel in the bottom couple layers to absorb extra moisture. And one very thoughtful listener also said that I should save money and buy giant heads of lettuce and get a salad spinner. But to buy organic head lettuce, it's actually more expensive than buying the tub of triple washed greens. So it's kind of a wash. And I actually think that the lettuce packagers know that you're going to lose a good portion of this giant tub of greens.
No word yet from any of the salad-making companies we reached out to on why so much lettuce gets soggy. Trent Jonas in Minneapolis wrote to us on Facebook to say that at the restaurant where he works, people are leaving money on the table when they don't eat all their food.
It's really troubling to me how much I see come back into the kitchen and then get thrown away. Food that I perceive as usable otherwise, if not resellable. But, you know, somebody could certainly eat half of a sandwich or something like that. Not to mention just the waste is, you know, a fiscal problem as well as a, you know, a social problem.
When you think about this and how it reflects your own life, has seeing that at work changed the way you use and prepare food at home?
It does. I tend to prepare either enough to keep eating or enough for one meal, but we don't throw things away. We save them or reuse them. We're all about leftovers. Or if eating out, my kids have been ingrained to get containers and take it home and not waste food. I also order the inventory for the restaurant, and so I know what ingredients we need, and that ups the cost of the restaurant when we over-serve. But, you know, we have the problem where some people may just not eat as much as we serve in a portion, and yet other people would complain if our portions got any smaller. So it's all over the board in terms of problematic for me.
How do you calibrate that as a business decision? Because obviously, I would imagine the margins, you know, could be significant if you're ordering too much that doesn't get used. I mean, walk me through the calculus.
One thing that we do is we control portions of certain things. So, for example, many of our things are served with salsa, which we make in-house, but, you know, we don't just put a tub of salsa on the table. We serve a 2-ounce portion with the things that come with salsa. And if you want extra salsa, it costs. And so that helps us both control the cost, and it makes the consumer, I think, make a decision about whether they're willing to either consume it and pay for it and consume it, or not pay for it or leave money on the table.
What else are you wasting? Here are a few responses we got on Facebook, read by the Marketplace staff.
I probably waste mental energy on worrying about events I can't control.
Commuting in cars, it squanders time, fuel, fresh air, real estate, community, taxes, safety, productivity, health, etc.
I waste a lot of time surfing the internet and reading articles. The opportunity cost can be enormous, figuring I could be using that time to do just about anything else that's actually productive.
We got a lot of great replies to this question, so we want to keep it going. Come tell us about what you waste and what you think it costs you. Go to Marketplace.org, Marketplace's Facebook page, or call us 1-800-648-5114. We have a story about another kind of systemic waste now. It turns out that every year, millions of dollars are, yes, literally, flushed down the toilet. Gold, other metals, valuable minerals, in what's called sewage sludge in our water systems. Paul Westerhoff is a professor of environmental engineering at Arizona State, and he studies this. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks, Lizzie.
I have been admittedly referring to this as the gold in poop interview.
Gee, I appreciate that.
I need to know how annoying that is to you as a scientist and how wrong or right I am.
So I don't think it's annoying as a scientist. I mean, we've published scientific papers and the peer review process looks at it from the scientific point of view. You know, I understand that there's significant value in trying to communicate what we do in science to the public. And if it means talking about gold and poop, that's good for me.
So how much money really are we talking about in terms of metals that are in what we flush down the toilet?
So the stuff that, you know, you flush down the toilet is worth somewhere between, you know, $10 and $13 million a year for a city of about 1 million people. As long as you realize that what goes down your toilet isn't everything that you discharge every day.
All of this stuff is in what's called sludge, I guess, in the sort of water treatment process. How did you figure out that there was valuable stuff in it?
So we started looking at this because we're actually interested in nanotechnology and what's going to happen to a lot of the nanoparticles that we're using. So if you brush your teeth in the morning with toothpaste that has titanium dioxide nanoparticles in it, and we were curious if it went in the water that left the treatment plant after it was purified. So we had to use what's called electron micrograph imaging. And what we saw was, yeah, we found titanium dioxide that looks like it came from your toothpaste. But then we also started to find these little nano-sized gold nuggets and silver nuggets. And so that got us thinking about what else is here.
How much does one person produce in terms of...
So each person discharges about $10 worth of gold a year. So you go to a lot of fancy parties and you eat fancy donuts. Sometimes they have a gold leaf on them. If you have a lot of bling on your teeth,
I've never had a cavity.
Well, that's a cavity, but there's a lot of people that, you know, decorate their teeth.
True.
There's a lot more gold floating around than you'd imagine. Actually, they put a lot of gold in different pharmaceuticals and other things. So,
if I were to think about this from an industrial use standpoint or a conservation standpoint, what could you do with all that stuff?
So we're interested in keeping phosphorus out of the environment so it doesn't lead to algae growth and rivers and stuff. So in one way, you know, kind of augmenting the removal of phosphorus by recovering these metals might help offset the cost of our kind of environmental impact.
Do you think that there's enough in it that it's a viable business model?
What I can say is that it would reduce the cost to a city by about 25% in terms of getting rid of its solids. Hmm. So your taxes could go down. You know, someone's not going to come in and make money selling gold, but it'll decrease the cost of treating wastewater.
If you think about mining this at the end of the treatment process, like, how would you do that? What's the technology?
The most kind of energy-intensive thing would be to literally burn it and take the ash and recover the metals out of there. But there's a number of technologies where you get rid of the organics, and in some cases you can actually produce oil as a byproduct. But you can find ways to kind of concentrate the metals down and then apply some of the same techniques as mining companies. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Is anybody doing it?
This is actively going on in a city in Japan, where they are recovering gold from sewage solids currently.
What are they doing with it?
They are recovering it, and that's about as far as they go. Now, in other countries, in Switzerland, they incinerate or burn the solids, and then they're putting them in two dedicated locations in Switzerland. And the idea is to not make a landfill out of these, but to put them all together such that in 10 or 20 years, they could go back and mine these facilities.
Paul Westerhoff from Arizona State, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie. That was fun.
Marketplace Weekend is supported by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Brains On is a science podcast for curious kids and adults. Each episode answers questions sent in from kids around the world. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and learn more at brainson.org.
We talked a little bit about the Panama Papers at the top of the show, and there have already been casualties of the data leak. Iceland, for example, has a new prime minister after its former one quit over revelations in the documents that his wife had a hidden offshore account. We have more now on elites operating on what you could say is their own financial system. The Panama legal firm at the heart of the controversy kept a lot of clients who were subject to international sanctions. Mossack Fonseca worked with 33 individuals or companies who, at some point, faced action from the U.S. Treasury. They include companies linked to North Korea's nuclear weapons program and a close relative of Syria's President Bashar al-Assad. Our partners at the BBC are part of the group of journalists working on the Panama Papers. Their Simon Cox has this story.
The gentle waters of this Caribbean tax haven are being whipped up by a global storm. It's all because of a law firm reached up a flight of narrow stairs at the top of an unassuming sky blue building. This is the office in the British Virgin Islands of law firm Mossack Fonseca.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out some information about a company that's registered here.
It's home to 100,000 companies, but they only exist on paper. We already know some have been used to evade taxes or launder money, but we can reveal that some of the companies set up by Mossack Fonseca have been subject to international sanctions. One of these firms is a company called Drex Technologies. The leaked documents reveal the real owner was Syrian businessman Rami Makhlouf, cousin of President Assad, reportedly worth $5 billion. He was sanctioned by the US in 2008 as a corrupt regime insider. David Lesh, a historian and biographer of Syrian President Assad, has met Rami Makhlouf.
He rose up at a young age in the business community, but he has spread his wings, or some in Syria would say tentacles, and there's virtually no area of Syria where you can do business without first getting the approval of Rami Makhlouf and his companies.
What's more, the files reveal the bank working for Rami Makhlouf and Drex Technologies while he was sanctioned was the Swiss arm of HSBC. In February 2011, this remarkable email was sent by Mossack Fonseca's compliance team after a conversation they had with HSBC.
The HSBC compliance department of the bank, not only in Geneva but also in their headquarters in London, know about Mr. Makhlouf and confirm that they're comfortable with him.
When Mossack Fonseca's head of compliance realised that Rami Makhlouf was on a sanctions list, they recommend to bosses dropping him as a client. But Chris Solinger, one of Mossack Fonseca's partners, replied,
"From my part, if HSBC headquarters in England do not have an issue with the client, then I think we can also accept him."
Mossack Fonseca finally stopped doing business with Rami Makhlouf and five other companies they had with him in September 2011. As for HSBC, we don't know. They told us they work closely with the authorities to fight financial crime and implement sanctions. Tom Keating, director of financial crime at the think tank RUSI, says they should have spotted the problem years before.
As soon as you're aware that an account holder is subject to sanctions, that account should be frozen and you should inform your local financial intelligence unit, the local authorities. To continue to operate with somebody sanctioned on your books is clearly irresponsible.
Rami Makhlouf wasn't a one-off. Most companies give any financial firms in North Korea a wide berth, but not Mossack Fonseca. In 2013, a North Korean bank called Daedong Credit Bank was sanctioned by the US for providing support to the country's nuclear missile program. The bank had set up a front company with the same initials called DCB Finance. This was also sanctioned by the US for raising funds for the North Korean regime since it was established in 2006. The company that had registered and run DCB Finance was Mossack Fonseca. They didn't take notice of the North Korea link until 2010, when they stopped doing business with DCB. This later email from Mossack Fonseca's legal department admits they'd made a big mistake.
We have not yet addressed the reason we maintained a relationship with DCB Finance when we knew or ought to have known from incorporation in 2006 that the country, North Korea, was on the blacklist.
And Martin Kenny, a lawyer in the British Virgin Islands who deals with fraud cases, can't understand how this slipped through the net.
It would be a serious compliance problem for a BVI trust company to agree to form a company for any person in North Korea without exceptionally extensive due diligence.
Mossack Fonseca said they never knowingly allowed the use of their companies by individuals having any relationship with North Korea or Syria, and they didn't foster or promote unlawful acts. But with 11 million documents, there are many more revelations to come.
That was the BBC's Simon Cox. There's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. Every week, Marketplace's senior tech correspondent Molly Wood shares her thoughts on what's happening in the world of tech and business. We call it The Dispatch, and here it is. Hit it, Molly.
The big tech story of the week is the sudden and unexpected death of the smart home. Okay, I'm exaggerating, but only a little. You know Nest, right? Makers of the crazy expensive smart thermostat and the crazy expensive smart smoke alarm. It's kind of been the poster products for the connected home, the perfect company. So perfect, it even got bought by Google and turned into Nest Labs. And Google also bought a little company called Revolve. They made a smart home hub. You'd plug it into your Wi-Fi router, and then it could control other gadgets in your house like light bulbs and alarms and things. And it made Revolve part of Nest Labs. And this week, owners of the Revolve smart hub found out, well, this.
There was a shutdown notice on the homepage saying that on May 15th, they would be shutting down, not only shutting down, but they would actually be disabling the devices and that the app you use to control the devices would no longer function.
That's Arlo Gilbert. He's the guy who kicked off a firestorm this week by blogging about the fact that Nest Labs was cutting off Revolve's head like it's a Game of Thrones character. The $300 piece of hardware that controls a big part of his house isn't going to work anymore. There is talk of Nest Labs compensating people somehow, maybe paying back the $300. It clearly kicked up more of a fuss than they expected. But here's the thing. This is not the first time Nest Labs has done this kind of thing with a beloved company that they acquired. Here's Matt Honan. He's bureau chief at BuzzFeed in San Francisco.
Not terribly long after Nest bought Dropcam, I don't remember exactly how long, but they swapped everyone over to Nest, right? Well, this happened when I was using my Dropcam as a baby monitor. And suddenly I could no longer log into my Dropcam. I couldn't reset my password from the app. And it was just, it was kind of a nightmare. And like what I definitely wasn't expecting was for my my ability to monitor my children to go away. Because Nest decided to turn off the thing that I've been using for a long time.
Now, given recent reports that Nest Labs isn't making a lot of money, and maybe most of the money they reportedly made in last quarter's earnings was from, well, buying Dropcam, it's fair to wonder what might happen to those other expensive hardware trinkets the company sells. So I asked Arlo.
What do you think it means for the industry? I mean, are you worried about your Nest thermostats now?
Well, I'm not worried about my Nest thermostats because when I sell my house in a month, my Nest thermostats are staying with it. And I will be buying a different brand of thermostats at my new house.
And this is important because there are high hopes for the smart home industry. Analysts throw around numbers like 700 million connected homes by 2020, a $70 billion market. And sure, it's chugging along, mostly on light bulbs. And this kind of thing might be a blip in the road to full home automation. But I will tell you, if this is the price you pay for being an early adopter, it is not that tempting to adopt. In other bummer news about a nascent industry, you guys, Oculus is just a hot mess. Despite a $1 billion investment from Facebook, this company cannot figure out how to ship a product. Early this week, there was news about major delivery delays for people who pre-ordered the new Rift virtual reality system. They were supposed to arrive March 28th. Now, customers are going to get an update on their delivery dates on April 12th. Yeah. Oculus said, it'll pay for shipping for these affected customers, but this is like insult to injury on the road to launching this thing. The Rift was supposed to ship in the first quarter of this year. Then it got pushed back to spring, minus the super innovative touch controller. That is officially delayed until the second half of this year, but probably longer. And the last time Oculus announced a new product version was when it revealed a big sexy prototype called Crescent Bay back in September 2014. I'm just saying, this is either a picture of a company that doesn't have it together, or it's proof that VR tech is really difficult. Sure making the road to VR seem a lot longer. Speaking of roads and maybe vaporware, see what I did there? Tesla just made $250 million taking pre-orders for the Tesla Model 3, which at this point is basically a concept car. It does not exist. It will not ship for at least a year, you hope. Because Tesla also reported this week that it was basically unable to build Model X vehicles during Q1 because, and I am paraphrasing Tesla's own words here, the company basically got cocky, put too much whiz-bang crap in the car, didn't make sure its suppliers could supply, and then couldn't make the parts themselves. People, just shop carefully, okay? That's all I'm asking here. And that's it for this week, everybody. Talk soon.
Want to hear more? Visit The Dispatch by Molly Wood on SoundCloud. Now to a systemic change happening across the country in the world of work and how much low-wage workers get paid. Nationally, the federal minimum wage remains $7.25 an hour, but several states and cities have moved or are moving to a $15 an hour minimum wage. What we don't know yet, largely because this is so new, is how this will work out, either for employees or whether higher wages will cost jobs. That is all still to come. But here's what we do know. This $15 an hour movement is not organic. It was the brainchild of a labor union. Josh Idelson at Bloomberg Businessweek has done some great reporting on this, and we brought him on. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Tell me a little bit about the landscape of the $15 minimum wage. Where has it gone into place, or will it go into place?
Sure. So a $15 an hour minimum wage, something that would have gotten you laughed out of a lot of rooms a few years ago, now is public policy. New York State and California are both en route to $15 minimum wage policies. We've seen cities like Seattle and San Francisco and Los Angeles pass plans that will bring them up to $15 an hour. 15 also is a resolution passed by the Democratic National Committee, a bill with support from some top Democrats in Congress. Public policy at the state level for home care workers in a couple states who are funded by Medicaid, and a major issue in the U.S. presidential election.
Yes, a few years ago, this would have seemed in some ways ludicrous that this could really be on the table. We've seen so much opposition to a raise in the minimum wage. How did we get here?
So the key factor in this is a campaign called the Fight for 15, which has been primarily funded and directed by the Service Employees International Union, the second largest union in the United States, and a union that, like really all of its peers, is facing an existential crisis given the political and economic attacks on organized labor. SEIU has made a big investment in this relatively unconventional campaign, which uses a combination of political and media and workplace and consumer tactics and pressure, on the one hand, on politicians to legislate improvements in the wage, and also on corporations to raise pay and also allow unionization. This is a campaign that really went public in late 2012, when just a couple hundred fast food workers in New York City mounted a one-day strike, something that really is unprecedented in the fast food industry in the U.S. And since then, we've seen those strikes migrate to include other industries, to include cities around the country, and also accompanied by a sophisticated, comprehensive campaign. So take the month of March, along with reaching these deals in California and New York, you had lower profile things happening, like a prosecutor in Brazil announcing an investigation of McDonald's, fast food workers in New Hampshire marching to protest the death in police custody of a Burger King worker, workers at airports going on strike, demanding 15 in a union. And so this combination of tactics together has changed the conversation in abstract ways and also led to a series of concrete victories.
Yeah, most fast food workers are not unionized, so why did they start there?
Among the explanations that you'll hear talking to people in and around SEIU is that this is an industry that is represents iconically bad jobs, that is almost entirely private sector, that is virtually non-union now. And SEIU is a union much of whose membership is made up of public employees and government-funded healthcare workers. And so part of the analysis from SEIU, as its president, Mary Kay Henry, said to me, this isn't just a do-good thing for SEIU. Part of the analysis was that if workers whose wages are taxpayer-funded are going to protect what they have and win more, they have to do something about what's happening first at the bottom of the economy. That if you don't do something about inequality and raise expectations for what everyone should get paid, it's going to be harder and harder to defend what you have in the public sector.
Let's spin this forward. So California's got to get to $15 an hour by 2022. What happens in 2035? Does this get a kind of wholesale policy evaluation and there's a fight for 25?
So some of the wage laws that we've seen pass around the country include indexing so that the minimum wage would continue to automatically go up based on the cost of living. That doesn't mean that advocates won't continue trying to go and raise it. But something else that we've seen that really distinguishes this fight from some of the living wage campaigns in the 90s is there's been more bundling the minimum wage together with other kinds of regulation in the workplace. So you see minimum wage bundled with something like a paid sick leave law or some kind of protection around people's scheduling, their ability to get their schedule or their ability to get compensated if their schedule is changed too late for them to change their plans. And this is something also that we're going to continue to see. And really, it speaks to how, as one commentator put it, it's easier now sometimes to raise wages for thousands of workers than to win a union contract for hundreds. And so some of the things that you might have seen in a union collective bargaining agreement, you see efforts now backed by unions to legislate in the workplace. And so that's a frontier that people are going to continue to pursue.
Josh Idelson is a writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Marketplace Weekend. There's a pretty intense theme park war going on in California. Universal is opening its latest challenge to Disneyland. It's the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, opened this week. The Harry Potter franchise has, of course, raked in billions, and Universal's already tapped into the built-in audience that loved the film and the books in Florida with one of their theme parks. That Harry Potter park has been a huge success. And analysts expect this new one in Hollywood will immediately increase park attendance by 20%, could bring in $100 million for Universal in the next year. The first few days were sold out, people were on the theme park rides, and yes, those are popular, but Universal is actually banking on concessions as the big hook here. If you read the books, you know Harry Potter's got a menu. Butterbeer, chocolate frogs, Bertie Bott's every flavor, beans, three proprietary alcoholic wizarding beers. It's a big list. We sent Marketplace Weekend producer Eliza Mills to get a taste of all of this, and she's with me now. Hi, Eliza.
Hi, Lizzie.
So tell me about the park.
It's kind of like being on the set of one of these Harry Potter movies down to the last detail. You're on a stone-paved street. It's a bustling little village full of snow-topped shops, and Hogwarts is looming over you on the hill.
So it sounds like you've walked into a movie.
It's like being on set.
A lot of this is very carefully branded. J.K. Rowling, we're talking about a global brand. How much of this has had her involvement in it?
Pretty much all of it. She's sort of working with the team who did art direction for the film on everything from the moss on the sides of the buildings to the packaging of the candy to the menu in the restaurants there.
This menu got careful oversight. I know you tasted it, but J.K. Rowling tasted it too, right?
She did. It took 15 taste tests for them to get butterbeer right. And Rowling did one of those. And what they ended up with are three versions, hot, cold, and ice. And it kind of tastes like butterscotch or shortbread.
How was it?
It was good. I think it lived up to the hype. I spoke to a 12-year-old girl named Mooring who was visiting the park with her family, and this is what she had to say.
It tasted like so much sugar in my mouth. It tasted so unbelievably good.
Obviously, that's what Universal wants to hear, right?
Definitely.
And how do concessions figure into this so much from a financial standpoint?
They're a huge part of theme park profits, about 30% of the profits.
Wow.
Yeah. And so Universal is kind of banking on Butterbeer the drink and Butterbeer the fudge and the ice cream, even though those aren't things that fans will have seen in the books or the movies.
But they work as an extension of the brand.
They work as an extension of the brand. And the newest iteration of Butterbeer is actually a pot de creme dessert developed by the head chef in the Hollywood Park, Eric Capello.
Of course, we wanted to find another home run when we started putting the Butterbeer idea together for dessert. It was, you know, this really makes sense. And, you know, there's more to come with other opportunities that we see with the Butterbeer. And this was just like the beginning of the future for us.
So it sounds like there's a lot more to come, yeah?
Yeah, there aren't any leaks on specific dishes, but it seems like Universal is kind of using Butterbeer as a chocolate or a vanilla flavor. It's their cash cow. And I thought maybe diluting that brand would dilute its selling power. So I called Sam Okus, the editor of food service magazine QSR, to see what he had to say. Here's Sam.
As we've seen with franchises in the past, like Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or whatever, you can make so much money off of these franchises, even through loose affiliations. I think that's a genius idea. I think there's so much opportunity.
Well, that kind of leads to the question of whether they take that opportunity outside the park and start selling this stuff in stores.
It's interesting. That's something that they've done with their other branded products. You can get Birdie Bot's Every Flavor Beans from Jelly Belly. You can order chocolate frogs online or buy these wool sweaters from the houses on the Universal website. But I don't think they're going to do it with Butterbeer. I spoke to Morel Marian, the senior VP of food operations at Universal Studios in Hollywood, and he says it's just not happening.
This is part of a fully immersive, themed experience that's authentic, and we would never want to touch that.
So Butterbeer, okay, stays in the park. It's non-alcoholic, but they do sell some booze for what? I guess we should say adult Harry Potter fans?
They sell a lot of booze. They have three beers that are just made for the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. And that's big inside the park, but it also could be an opportunity for Universal outside the park. And that's something I talked to Sam Okus about.
You're sitting on a gold mine. If you consider the fact that, and using me as an example, millennials grew up with Harry Potter books. Millennials now of age are looking for artisan liquors and artisan beers. Millennials are the ones who love these products with stories behind them. And so Harry Potter, perhaps more so than any other franchise in America, has this opportunity to tap into millennials like no other.
That's the thing that really interested me about this, because you didn't just see kids there, did you?
No, I mean, there are kids there and they're having fun, but a lot of the people wandering around the park on the preview day when I went were 20-somethings, 30-somethings, wanting a butter beer, but maybe also a drink and a sweater and a look back at their childhood.
And that stuff really sells. Eliza Mills, thank you very much.
Thanks, Lizzie.
Inspired by our Harry Potter story this week, the whole Marketplace Weekend team took the Sorting Hat quiz on J.K. Rowling's Pottermore site. Three of us are Gryffindors, including me. One is a Ravenclaw. What are you? And that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll have some of our favorite personal stories about money. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan, Eliza Mills, and with help this week from Levi Sharp. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Ben Tolliday and Charlton Thorpe are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.